Hello again, and welcome to the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network and our first recorded episode of the Global Exchange podcast for 2019. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Colin Robertson. On this episode, we look forward into 2019, what we should be looking for, including those things that go bang in the night, and those issues that should be looked at as we head into a federal election this fall. I speak to CJAI fellows Sarah Gold, Feder, Andrew Griffith, Andrew Rasulis, and my co-host on this network, Vice President David Perry. A special welcome to Jacob Pushter, Associate Director at Pew Research Center. He is an expert in international survey research and writes about international public opinion on a variety of topics, including the international image of the United States, technology use around the world, views about extremism in predominantly Muslim nations and in the West, and public opinion on international threats. He is also responsible for designing survey questionnaires, managing survey projects, analyzing data, and writing fact tank blog posts. And I have gained a lot from reading them, and I recommend to listeners that they go to the Pew site, and we'll actually post that on the information for this broadcast. Jacob, let me start off with you and ask you for a summary of some of the fascinating findings. And listeners, as I mentioned, we're going to post that on the CJA website. First of all, views of President Trump.
So overall, we did a survey in 2018 across 25 nations around the world, and we saw that generally there's not a lot of confidence in U.S. President Donald Trump. Across those 25 countries, 70% have no confidence in him to handle international affairs, while 27% have confidence in him. And these numbers are much lower than they were for Obama when he was president of the United States.
And my sense is lower for Donald Trump than for previous presidents, not just Obama, but George W. Bush.
In fact, it was quite similar to what it was for George Bush.
Okay.
So we found similar levels of lack of confidence in the U.S. president for Trump than we did for Bush in many of the countries, which we have data going back to 2007.
Okay, Canada-U.S. relations, obviously, and you've got a section on that as well. Give us a sense how Canadians view Americans and how Americans view Canadians. And you also had some really interesting facts about differentiation in the Canadian parties on certain issues.
Right. So Canadians, only a quarter have confidence in President Trump versus 75% who have no confidence in him. And 39% of Canadians have a favorable view of the U.S., which for us is a historic low since we've been tracking since 2002. That's the fewest number of Canadians who have a positive view of the U.S. By party, the people who support the Conservative Party tend to be more favorable towards the U.S. and have more confidence in President Trump versus those who support the NDP and the Liberal Party, who generally have less favorable views of the United States and have less confidence in President Trump.
Now, Jacob, trade has been a really big issue for Canada, the United States, and Mexico over the last couple of years with the NAFTA negotiations leading now to a NAFTA 2.0 or 0.8 or whatever we want to call it, the Canada-U.S.-Mexico Agreement or U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, again, depending where you sit, slightly different title. How do Canadians and Americans view trade?
Sure. Well, when we ask a general question on whether they support trade with other countries, both Canadians and Americans like the idea of trade. 89% of Canadians say that it's good for their country, and 74% of Americans say that. But when we get into the specific benefits of trade, like whether does trade create increase wages, does it create jobs, or does it decrease prices, we get less consensus that these things actually come to pass when you have trade with other countries. So when you get down to the details, not as positive for trade as it is seen generally.
Now, the rule of thumb for Canadians was that Democrats tended to be more protectionist and Republicans more free trade inclined. But as Donald Trump takes a kind of, he's a mercantilist, he's talked about trade not working for the United States and having to redo deals because, is that having an effect on the public opinion of Republicans with Donald Trump really being one of the most anti-free trade Republicans that I can think of since the Second World War?
So there's two aspects. On trade with other countries, both Republicans and Democrats like the idea of it, but Democrats are slightly more positive on it. But when it comes to the tariff issue, you definitely see a difference of opinion between Republicans and Democrats in the U.S., where Republicans are more likely to say that tariffs placed on its trading partners is good for the United States, and Democrats are more likely to say that those tariffs are actually bad for the United States. States. So that's where you see the very large differentiation in American public opinion.
Now, one of the things that surprised me was that, notwithstanding what you've just said, that overall attitudes towards trade in the United States by Republicans, Democrats, Americans generally, was actually higher than what many Canadians might have thought. Am I not correct in that most Americans actually see advantages to trade?
Yeah, when you ask them in general language whether they think trade with other countries is a good thing, yes, Americans agree that it is. It's just when you get down to the specifics on whether, you know, it's good for various aspects of the American economy when it gets a little more confusing, and then on tariffs itself, you know, where Republicans think tariffs on other countries are a good idea and Democrats think tariffs on other countries are a bad idea. That's where you get a lot of the differentiation on trade overall.
Now, one of the questions I think you asked was, and it was partly how Mr. Trump's been saying that America's been had, taken advantage of. Do Americans feel that?
Over time, there is a sense that Americans say that other countries take unfair advantage of the U.S., but that number has changed over time. Back in the 90s, large majorities of Americans said that this was the case. But in current America, it's more of a split option where just over half say other countries take advantage of the U.S., while about 43% say that they treat the U.S. fairly. But there's also a large partisan divide. Republicans are much more likely to say that other countries take unfair advantage of the U.S. compared to Democrats. And that's also a big change that we've seen since 1994. And it sort of represents an increase in polarization among the American public on foreign policy issues.
The other big basket for Canada is defense and security issues. What does the polling tell us on defense and security, Canada-U.S. relations?
I mean, generally, Americans are very positive on their NATO allies, on views of the United Nations, on sort of the overall defense agreements that are in place. And there's a general sense among NATO countries as well that there's positive, you know, that it's a positive thing. And many Americans are also willing to say that if there was a NATO ally attacked, for instance, by either Russia or potentially an ally in the Asia Pacific attacked by China or North Korea, that Americans would come to their aid.
So there is support for the Article 5
right.
That gets a fair bit of attention.
There's still support in America for keeping up those treaty obligations in the current era.
What about third big basket, which is energy, environment, climate, Americans and Canadians? Any sense there of where we're coming from?
Well, in our past research, we found that Americans do see climate change as a threat, as a lot of other international publics do. But there is a very large partisan divide in the United States about climate change and about its effects, where Democrats are a lot more concerned about it. They say it's a much bigger public priority, and Republicans are less concerned about climate change overall. So, I mean, those climate issues are part of the American public. And then in 2017, we also asked about people around the world what they thought about Donald Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. And there was overwhelming disapproval among all publics, including Canada, that was a bad idea.
Another big issue that certainly has been playing a fair bit in the United States is the whole around migration. Where are Americans on migration issues?
Well, and when you look at it across the world, Americans actually tend to be some of the most pro-immigration publics that we survey. But overall, most Americans would prefer that the number of immigrants to their country remain about the same as it is now. And Canadians are similar. About the same percentage in both countries say that the same number of immigrants that come to their countries now should be allowed in. And about 30% of Americans say there should be fewer or none. So, I mean, overall, that doesn't mean that they want more immigrants. But compared to other countries around the world in which we survey, it's actually a slightly more pro-immigrant stance.
Again, as we go into 2019, we're in the midst of a China-U.S. trade dispute, which has security implications as well. Where are Americans on China? And I think you said that your polling, you don't do polling in China because it's hard to do. But where are Americans on China?
Yeah, Americans have sort of mixed views of China. So on one hand, they don't have particularly favorable views of China. But overall, the unfavorable views of China are not overwhelming. The things that they worry about in terms of China are more about the economic relationship rather than the military relationship. And when we ask people who's the most important foreign policy partner for Americans, China is the second highest country picked. So China's high in the minds of people, but when it comes to the issues between China and the United States, it's almost entirely couched in the economic relationship between the two powers rather than the military relationship.
Now, what about Russia?
So Russia is seen negatively by countries around the world, including the United States, and there's not much confidence in President Putin around the world as well, although his confidence ratings are about equal to that of Donald Trump and are the lowest among the five leaders that we tested internationally. So of the five leaders, Angela Merkel is seen as people have the most confidence in her, followed by Emmanuel Macron from France, with Xi Jinping sort of in the middle. And then the lowest ratings come for Vladimir Putin of Russia and Donald Trump of the United States.
Okay, Jacob, now I'm going to ask you a question, which I'm going to ask the others around the table. What are you looking forward for in 2019? What are some of the big trends or things that you've been watching, which you want to see how they play out in this coming year?
So we're gonna continue to look at how people view democracy around the world, about how the rise of populist parties, both in Europe and in other countries, has sort of affected how people see the fundamental aspects of democracy. We're also gonna look a little more into globalization, whether people think that the world is more diverse, whether there's more gender equality or less gender equality, and whether other aspects of their culture has been overwhelmed by globalization. And finally, as we get towards the end of the year, we're going to look back at some of our long-term trends in Europe to see how things have evolved in Europe 30 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And we're trying to do a survey on that work later on in 2019.
Anything that surprised you over the last year in doing your survey research and looking at trends?
I mean, the overall image of the U.S. has sort of remained low, and that change from 2016-15 to 2017-18 has remained. I was sort of surprised that there wasn't maybe a further erosion of American favorability around the world, but it seems to have maintained a level of where it was in 2017. So I think that's one of the surprising aspects that I found in our survey this year.
And if listeners want to know more about Pew, where do they go and can they sign up to get sort of things sent to them if you want?
Yes, our main site is pewresearch.org. And if you do a /, and say global, you can get to the global research. And on the website, you can sign up for newsletters from our various research arms, and as well as search for questions from our past. And if you really want to, you can actually download our data sets in SPSS format, if people have that program, and they can analyze the data themselves and come to their own conclusions with the data that we make available on our website.
Thank you, Jacob, and I give a personal plug for Pew. I rely heavily on what you produce, and I find your blogs and the rest really useful. Now let me turn around and ask Sarah Goldfeather. Sarah, as you look into 2019, as you look at particular, let's start with the U.S., and then I'm going to ask you about trade. What are you looking for?
What am I looking for? What do I expect to see? Because
what I'm looking for
is definitely a move towards a more unifying version of policy, but I don't think I'm going to find that this year. What I think the year has been marked with so far is an increasing divisiveness. The rhetoric on both sides, between the Republicans and the Democrats in Washington, has marked their differences, not the areas where they have ability to collaborate. And I think that's going to be really indicative of the remainder of 2019 in this legislative year for the United States Congress, the 116th, is it's really, increasingly you hear individual senators that belong to the Republican Party willing to reach across the aisle and find some area that they can work with Democrats on, but at the head of that party is a president who is not interested in negotiating with the leadership of the Democrats. And so I think that that's going to define the remainder of the year. So my hopes for collaboration and a more coherent policy coming out of the United States, I think, are going to be disappointed. And I think we're going to see even more confrontation between the two sides.
Now, we're also a year away from the Iowa caucus and then moving into the primaries. I guess we'll be seeing action both, particularly on the Democratic side, to choose someone to challenge Mr. Trump, assuming Mr. Trump is the contender and gets through the Mueller inquiry.
And all of that drama is beginning now, right? We've already seen a couple of people come out and declare that they think they're going to set up exploratory committees. You have Elizabeth Warren already firmly on the campaign trail. Kamala Harris just released a book this week, so we see her starting on the campaign trail. Beto O'Rourke live-streamed his dental cleaning appointment yesterday, so I'm not really quite sure what that means. But it definitely means the campaign season is underway. And I think, you know, in some ways that may give us messages of hope, and in other ways it may just give us more despair. So we'll see.
Now, what about trade? We spent much of the last year, and you've been a frequent participant in our discussions on trade. Will the Canada-U.S. or U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement get through the Congress this year?
I'm not sure. And I'm not sure that matters too much, because as long as NAFTA's in place, I think we've got a safety net there that will provide the stability that the three countries are looking for. I think that the trade agenda for the Canada-U.S. relationship is going to be focused on the 232 steel and aluminum tariffs initially. And I think that we're a long way from finding a pathway to any solution on those. And I think that's quite frustrating to the Canadians. And I think with the 2019 election year underway here in Canada, you're going to find a situation where the Prime Minister and his team are going to be hard-pressed to put forth ratification legislation onto the floor to the House of Commons, because the United States is not willing to move on the 232 tariffs. And so they've got a political problem there that they're going to have to manage. But in the end of the day, I think the trade discussion for 2019 is going to continue to be all about China, both on the pros and the cons in both the United States and Canada. And that will continue to define how the United States manages the Canadian trade relationship. And so Canada needs to figure out what its messaging back to the United States is going to be on that.
Well, listeners can be assured we'll be coming back to trade and Canada-U.S. relations. So thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome.
Let me shift across the table to Andrew Rasoulas. Andrew, you've been looking at Eastern Europe. You've been looking at Russia. What's going on there? We did a podcast with you not too long ago. But as we look into 2019, what are you looking for?
Okay, thanks, Colin. So the big picture then. The conflict between Russia and Ukraine over Ukraine's desire to move west remains in the forefront. As we ended 2018, we had, of course, the naval conflict, if you will, in the Sea of Azov. So the sharp line from being just strictly on the Donbass, the border area, it actually now moved into the Kerch Straits, where the Ukrainians tried to run the straits, and the Russians imposed their joint responsibility for those straits and seized three Ukrainian ships, and there are 24 members of the crew. So that's where we ended the year, and we now enter 2019 with presidential elections in Ukraine. Scheduled for the 31st of March with runoffs on the 21st of April. And also of note is the parliamentary elections at the end of October. So it's an election year in Ukraine, which means that politically speaking, they're going to be not able to make any large moves on this one. In terms of who's doing what, Yulia Tymoshenko consistently is polling in the lead. She's a long-term Ukrainian politician, came to fame in 2004 during the Orange Revolution. She has been able to bridge both sides of the East-West divide. She has relationships with Putin. She has relationships with the West. So she's actually a very interesting candidate in this, and she's a long-term politician. Poroshenko, the current president, remains back in the pack. He got a bit of a bump with the conflict in the Sea of Azov. He's now polling third. But interestingly enough, at the end of December, a new candidate came forward. It's a Ukrainian comedian. He runs a show, a primetime television show in Ukraine, and he's now polling second. So it's an active and dynamic situation there. So I think politically it means there'll be no deal probably in terms of a settlement. Will there be military interactions? Quite likely. Both sides have certain advantages of mixing things up for their various interests. So I think we can see limited military conflict, but really the emphasis will be on the Ukrainian elections.
Okay, anything about Russia that we should be watching?
I mean, the key thing there is that Putin now is facing more of a political reality comparable to other elected leaders, if you will, in the sense that his numbers are down, which is difficult for him. The pension issue in Russia is substantial. He has paid a penalty popularity for that. On the other hand, it does show that they are taking economic responsibility for the management of their budget, and their revenues are down. The sanctions are hitting. Oil prices are down. These things are all affecting the Russians in a negative way economically. They've had to make reforms. They have made the reforms, though. It shows responsibility, but his numbers are down. He's still popular by a majority, but he's nowhere near where he has been in the past. But there's no reason to suspect any upheaval in Russia in the short term, at least.
Okay. Let's shift now to issues of migration and multiculturalism. And our fellow Andrew Griffiths, my friend Andrew, you've done a lot of work in this area. What are you looking for, and where do you see things going in 2019 on the big issue of migration?
Well, I think the big issue is how immigration issues will play out in the 2019 election and how the political parties position themselves for the debates. And in one sense, it's virtually impossible to win a majority government in Canada unless you win over a good plurality of immigrant voters, visible minority voters. There are 41 ridings, sort of the GTA area and the Lower Mainland of BC, where visible minorities and their children are the majority.
So 41 ridings. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And
because we really are an immigrant receiving country. Was 1% of our population here is what we sort of bring in?
Yeah. Yeah. And there are a number of other ridings where they're close to 50%. But these ridings can shift and flip, because the Conservatives won most of the ridings prior in the 2011. The Liberals won most of them in 2015. And the Doug Ford Conservatives in Ontario, which have the same riding boundaries, won most of those ridings. So the degree to which economic issues and how they're presented and immigration-specific issues will be determined, will be interesting to watch. And whether it'll be some of the specific policies, because the Liberals won in part in those ridings because they addressed family reunification pressures that engaged support in the communities. But the Conservatives are sort of trying another approach, which is really to focus on, is the immigration system well managed? Are the borders controlled? And that resonates with Canadians, whether they're immigrants or non-immigrants, because there's a feeling that people are jumping the queue. But if they play the card too hard, that will create a backlash, much as the previous Conservative government did when they discovered playing with citizenship revocation or playing with barbaric cultural practices created an unease among those communities in terms of how they would respond. The other factor that I'm sort of curious to see, like both major parties are doing to a certain extent virtue signaling to their respective bases in terms of how they present themselves to potential voters. But I'm curious in particular to see whether and if there's an effect of Bernier in terms of pulling the Conservatives further to the right. And you could argue, but I have no substantiation here, that their opposition to the Global Compact on Migration, which really wasn't a binding agreement, was partially to address those perceptions or those concerns.
Now, why don't you tell listeners a little bit about the Global Compact on Migration, which we've heard a fair bit above. My sense is you think it's a good thing.
Well, I mean, I think it's, when I look at it and when I read what I would consider to be the informed commentary on it, it's non-binding. It's calling for managed immigration. It makes a distinction between regular planned-for migration and the measures that states can take to control irregular migration. So I don't see it as limiting in any way the Canadian government's flexibility and the powers the Canadian government has to regulate and manage its immigration system. I think a lot of the fears are just overblown. Now, of course, as some have argued, to sort of say, well, it may not be non-binding, but 10, 15 years, who knows? Well, if the international community decides to make it binding, Canada will have a role to play in deciding whether we support that or not.
Okay, let me shift over now to defense and security issues and my co-host on the Canadian Global Affairs Global Podcast Network, Dave Perry. Dave, looking at defense and security issues going forward into 2019, what are you watching for?
So I'd say three things. Peacekeeping, procurement, and then in part to start off where we began this podcast, looking at North America. So this summer, the government has made quite clear that it's going to end our peace support operation in Mali, which is kind of interesting for a government that had the biggest focus of its campaign platform in the last election, I would argue, beyond reinvigorating our participation in peace support operations with the UN. The only mission that it, of consequence that it has on right now is going to come to a close, and it will effectively leave that issue, I think, hanging quite a bit. In terms of procurement, broadly speaking, we've seen some positive trends in the, over the last year and a bit. The government's actually getting more money out the door, so if you use that as a measure for how they're faring on that particular issue, there's been some positive momentum in that respect. And then there's two big files hoping to see some concrete action on over the next year. Last fall, the government identified a preferred bidder in the competition to pick the design for the next round of surface ships for the Navy. There's some different legal actions underway from people that weren't identified as being the preferred bidder, and we'll see how those play out. But I think it looks like we're likely to actually get a contract on that project sometime early this winter, which would be a good step forward. And the other big procurement file is a fighter program. The government's basically trying to make up for lots of lost time and to try and get an actual final version draft, final version of a request for proposal out to industry in the spring. And I think all that will depend on what kind of feedback the government got from industry when it solicited that just prior to Christmas. And then the last issue, to circle back on, which would be quite interesting in the context of some of the Pew data about attitudes of Canadians towards the United States, one of the biggest kind of undefined issues that there hasn't been much public evidence about forward progress on has been North American defense modernization. Writ large, a modernization of NORAD specifically, that was a pretty significant chunk of the policy construct outlined in Strong, Secure, Engaged in June of 2017, and most of that work still remains to be done. So particularly in a context where you now have Canadian attitudes toward the United States less favorable than they've basically been in the last generation, interesting to see whether or not there's actually appetite to move forward on that front.
All right, now let me turn now to the listener's favorite. And what are you reading these days, Dave?
So since Ian Brody's now joined us as our program director, I thought I'd better finish off his most recent book, which I had gotten about two-thirds of the way through. So I'm currently finishing At the Center of Government by Ian Brody.
And I give it two thumbs up. Perfect. Andrew, what are you reading these days? Andrew Griffith.
Oh, well, I'm doing a fun read. I'm reading Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run. And it's such a great read. He's such a great storyteller. And you should watch the Netflix version of it if you can, but well worth it.
Jacob, let me ask you what you're reading these days.
Sure. I'm reading a book called Difficult Conversations. It's about how to manage conversations with people when you're either giving bad news or you have some emotional context. And it's sort of helping me learn how to communicate with other people in non-ideal situations.
Well, let me tell you did a splendid job today, so it's clearly working for a discussion around this table. Sarah, what about you?
I'm going to throw in some fiction with Killing Commendatore by Harukumi Murakami, which is he's a Japanese writer. He's kind of a surrealist novelist, and it's the perfect antidote to the news right now.
Perfect. Andrew Rasilis, what about you?
Well, since we last spoke at the end of the year, I'm not such a fast reader, so I'm still on Timothy Barnes' Constantine.
Okay. And I'll tell, I have just finished early this morning Ian Rankin's latest Rebus novel. For diversion, nothing beats them. Well, thank you for listening to this episode of The Global Exchange. We were joined today by our special guest, Pew Foundation Associate Director Jacob Pushter, and CJA Fellows Sarah Goldfeder, Andrew Griffith, Andrew Rasilis, and my co-host on the network, Dave Perry. You can find all of the work on the CJA website, and we will be posting the presentation made by Jacob on our website. Remember, you can find the CJA Network on iTunes, Google Play. If you like the show, please remember to give us a rating on iTunes. It really helps the podcast grow. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJIA. Thanks go out to producer Jared Malte and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on the Global Exchange.